Let's bring in Mr. John Cleese. Wow, I'm so excited. And here is John. There he is, Mr. John Cleese. Good morning.
Thank
you. Come on in and join us.
Do I need to put these on?
Yeah. You don't have to put them on. You can wear them if you want. I sound a lot sexier with headphones on.
You do.
My voice is very sexy by the time it goes through the microphone.
Well, mine's a little bit dark brown today.
I like that, though.
You know, I've got a touch of a head cold.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so either that or I'm dying. It's very hard to tell.
Let's hope it's a cold.
Yes, when you're 72, you really can't tell.
But you're a young 72.
Well, I was going to say something naughty, but anyway.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming in this morning.
Well,
I'm a
nice
huge fan.
I'm
a massive fan of yours.
No, you're not. You're
I am.
You're about 5'9".
Well, do you know what? I'll take 5'9", John.
Yeah, because it's actually taller than the truth.
Yeah.
She's 5'8", I think.
Is it?
Yeah, we're about the same.
You know, in history, no one over 5'8" ever caused any trouble.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a nice routine about it, but if you look at it, whether it's Genghis Khan or Napoleon
sure.
or Franco or Mussolini or Stalin,
yeah,
or, they're
right.
all 5'8", 5'6".
So we're the troublesome ones, then,
yeah,
in many ways, historically.
Yeah, anyone tall, you can rely on them, won't cause any trouble at all.
Yeah.
Well, I come from a long line of short Moyleses. I did. That's the one thing I did, you know the TV show Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
I did that, and the one thing that I left with was what my surname meant, and we're all short. We're all short.
Short from where?
From the bottom up.
Or the top down.
Where are you from? What part of the world?
My dad's family is Ballinar, kind of Mayo in Ireland.
Oh,
and
right.
all the Moyleses, all the Moyles men were
right.
short. And they all went to war, and which is pointless, because I think my ancestors are the only people who stood up in the trenches quite happily and nothing happened.
No fear of getting hit.
And then the one time it did pop his head out, boom, straight through the forehead.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's funny. Well, you know my family name was Cheese, don't you?
Right.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah,
it
really was.
Oh,
yeah, Dad
that.
Changed it in 1915 when he went into the First World War because he was fed up with being teased, so he changed the H to an L. And then he did it by some legal thing called deed poll afterwards. But I don't know what the point was, because at school I was always Old Cheese. No one ever thought of calling me anything else.
Sure, that's the thing.
And the one thing about getting, what is the word, becoming a celebrity is that people now know the name, because they couldn't hear it before. They'd say, what are you, Cleaves? Cleese? It didn't sound like anything.
Well, we were just debating this morning, because I've heard some people call you Cleese, you know, John Cleese as opposed to Cleese, and we're saying,
the Americans, baby.
Oh, they say Cleese today.
Cleese, yes, and I do point out, they don't say Pleese.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's once people have heard that, then it does get repeated.
Yeah.
But here I tend to get called Cleese, which I prefer, because actually, I'll tell you the real truth is that my dad always said Cleese, so I said Cleese. But the funny thing is, my mum, I heard her say Cleese.
Oh, really?
And I kind of remember thinking once, if your parents can't agree about the pronunciation
yeah,
of the family name, you know?
And then the general public actually are entitled to
have a few
call
choices.
You what they want, to an extent, yeah.
Well, look at you, John. John Cheese, look at you. Haven't you come a long way?
Yes. Come from Weston-super-Mare, my dear.
Is that where you came from today?
Well, no, yesterday.
Right.
I turned the lights on in Bath.
Oh,
someone had
beautiful.
Turned them off and there was a panic down there, so I went down
people
and
running around
sorted
the dark.
It out. Yeah, that's my part of the world, though.
Is that where you live now?
I have a little flat in Bath, but I don't get down there as much as
right.
I'd like. I don't know where I live anymore.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very strange thing to say, but it's true, because I was planning to come back here. Jenny and I decided that we'd get a slightly larger flat in Bath. And then somebody said, do you realise if you come back to England now, because I've been based in America for a few years,
sure.
For various reasons, and all of which have kind of disappeared, they said you can't charge the alimony against income. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, in America, you earn $1 million, give that to Alice Faye, then you can start earning for yourself. In England, I would have to earn $2 million, pay 50% tax on that, give the balance to Alice Faye, and then I could start earning for myself, meaning each year for the next 4 years, I'd have to start $2 million in the red. Well, I can't do that.
No.
So I'm
going
to have to
nobody could they?
Well,
mean, frankly.
It's ridiculous. And so I'm going to have to go and sit somewhere like Monaco or Switzerland
until
the alimony's paid off, and then come back and live in Bath, which is the most beautiful city I've ever been in.
Beautiful place.
What an amazing thing that John is here now going... I'm going to have to go and live in Monaco now. This is rubbish. And by the way, Monaco is not cheap.
No, it's not cheap, but if you get away from the casino, the prices are okay. But if you hang around and eat in the restaurants by the casinos, they're enormous prices. They're even higher than London.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, just never forget how expensive London is.
Cool, yeah.
Well, do you know what? Everywhere is expensive. I remember when I was a kid growing up, I used to go to Ireland a lot. I used to go to Dublin a lot. And Dublin was more expensive than Leeds, obviously being a capital city. And then I moved to kind of around the UK, and then I get to London, and you get used to London prices and whatnot, and then you realise that actually everywhere now seems expensive.
Everywhere, Josh.
You know, like,
right.
When I first came to London, Dave and I would go to the pub, and we'd go, we found a pub round the corner. It's less than £2 a pint. Mm. And we would go. And now, it doesn't matter where you're in Middlesbrough, London, New York, Manchester. It's expensive everywhere.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Although, strangely, when you, and you must find this, going back and forth to the States, is actually America feels relatively affordable now.
Yeah,
I think when
is.
You go out there.
For things like DVDs and clothes. And
but even for food.
Not for John, though. He's got no money.
Well, no, true. But even for food and drink and whatnot, I think.
I've got enough, my dove. Don't worry about me.
Well, I am
a
worried
bloody
about
bore
you.
Having to pay this stuff every year. It's so, only 4 more years.
Let me just explain for those people who don't know. So John got divorced.
Yeah.
And there's no coincidence that John's tour is called the Alimony Tour.
Absolutely.
Because he has to pay alimony.
Yeah.
Now,
which is maintenance. Is it not?
Yes, it's a mixture. You split up the assets and then I pay some every year. So far I've paid $17 million to Andre, and then I have to pay another million for the next 4 years. So
that's why
I'm traveling around all the time.
John, you didn't sign a prenup.
I did, but this, as you get older, you've realised nothing works.
Right.
But everyone in England now realises, this country doesn't work anymore, does it? Everything goes wrong. We got the worst press in the world. You know, nothing really works reliably.
Wow.
And once you realise that, you relax a bit. And you just say, well, I did have a prenup. It just wasn't legally enforceable under English law at that time. Then, to my astonishment, it wasn't enforceable under Californian law either.
Wow.
And then I discover I can't come back here and set it against it. It's a mess.
Well, how long were you married?
We survived.
How long were you married for?
16 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, if you're ever anybody listening and go to California, first of all, this is how to get rich in California. Find somebody rich, all right? Marry them, stage two. Next stage, the next morning, stop work.
Mm.
So you don't have any way of supporting yourself. The next thing you do is that you go out and spend as much money as you possibly can. Because that establishes that you have a very, very, very high standard of living.
Right.
And then you get divorced 4 years later and you're rich
you
for
need
life.
To maintain that lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a really moral system.
John, I'm no psychologist or expert in psychology, but I take it you're not best of friends anymore with...
Well, she always said that we wouldn't speak.
Right.
If we broke up, and I didn't think she was serious, but it's turned out to be a very good arrangement.
Tell you what, I won't speak to you for less money than you pay her. I've not spoken to you ever before in my life for free.
Well, Sam in Leeds has a 70p drinks on a Thursday in Leeds.
Oh, there you go, John. 70p drinks in Leeds.
Now, is that sparkling or plain?
Oh, didn't go into that detail. Mm.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's mostly covered.
85 for sparkling.
Yeah.
Well, the DVD is out. This is John's. This is your first live kind of UK tour
your own. Ever. Because I started in the theatre. That's how I got into this business back, if you can believe this, in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I can't believe that.
Unbelievable. It was the Camelish Footlights show that year. Happened to be very good. And it was not because of me, but because Bill Oddie was in it and Tim Brooke Taylor was in it. And all the critics went crazy about both of them. Bill had written some really good parodies of pop songs and he sang them almost like a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim was a very good, but very physical comedian, but very sort of precise in his movement. And they were the two stars of the show. And there were a couple of other people like myself, David Hatch, who went on to sort of rise up the hierarchy of the BBC, and Humphrey Barclay, who did a very good job producing a lot of television programs.
A lot of TV shows.
And that show ran in the West End for 5 months. And by the time I finished, I paid off all my student fees. Can you believe how lucky that is?
That's very lucky.
And then I got a job in the dear old old BBC writing for Dick Emery. Do you remember Dick Emery? And yeah. Derek Giler.
Nice.
And there I was sitting there quite happily, and then about 6 or 9 months later, they said, that show that you did in the West End, do you want to take it to New Zealand? And we all said, well, that'd be a giggle. And we took it to New Zealand. That was 1964, except in New Zealand it was 1902.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it was just hilarious. Yeah, Bill Oddie went into an ice cream parlour and asked for a banana split, and the guy quite solemnly got a banana, peeled it, split it. They had no idea what was going on. And then we went on to Broadway.
Yeah.
We didn't last very long.
How old are you? You must be, what, 25, around about that age?
No, I was 21 my first year at Cambridge, because they'd abolished national service, and that meant that I had to wait 2 years to get in.
Okay.
And I taught in my old prep school for £5 a week. How about that?
Nice.
£5 a week.
Hey, just think,
and I lived on it. Fine.
You can take that gig back again, John. That's another £5.
Well, every time I hand over 20 quid note to a taxi driver, I think that was a month's salary with us.
Wow.
1958.
You know, when I look back, obviously at the start of your career and how Python got started, and everybody writing, and you know, writing together and on all these things. Like for me now, when I first started doing bits of TV, mm-hmm. I was like so excited. Getting on the television was huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you have that? Did you feel like, my God, we have made it? Or was it just fun or a job? Or like, do you remember what your emotions were?
Well, I may say it's a very interesting question. Well, part of it was terror.
Right.
Because I'd done very little. I'd just been in the West End for 5 months, and I'd written a bit for radio, but my performing was totally in the theatre. And then David Frost rang me up at the end of 65 and said, hello, it's David. And I'd been in contact with him at Cambridge, and he said, I'm doing a show in the new year for the BBC. Super, super show, sketches with two people you won't have heard of called Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett. Would you like to be in it? Out of the blue. And I was sitting there in New York. I said, well, yes, please. So March of the next year, just 3 months later, there I was appearing on the Frost Report. No experience at all. We used to do it live to 14 million people. Yeah. And I've honestly, I really mean this, I've never been so frightened in my life. I used to have a pee about three times in the hour before the show went out. And I remember once I had a pee and I was washing my hands and I looked in the mirror and I thought I could not be more scared if I was going out into the ring to be a matador with a bull. I mean, it was terrifying. And I sort of got through it. I mean, one time I remember what happened, and because the fear, you know, you're always thinking, what's the next line, what's the next line, what's the next line, because you don't want to dry in front of 14 million people.
Absolutely.
So I was doing this sketch of Ronnie Corbett, and there'd been a little bit of dialogue. It was a cocktail party sketch, and a little bit of dialogue had been put in, and then the director had cut it, and then he'd put it back in again. And then during rehearsal, he'd said, no, we'll take it out. And then he'd said, put it back. And we got to the bit. I suddenly realized, I don't know, is it in? Is it out? And I went blank for just a split second. And I knew enough. Keep talking. The one thing you mustn't do is just go silent.
Right.
So I kept talking, and at the end of it, I said to Ronnie Corbett, oh, sorry, he said it was all right. I said, did I get away with it all right? Did anyone notice? And Ronnie said, well, there was one moment. You remember when you were supposed to say, I think you must be the smallest person I've ever met? I said, yes. He said, well, you said, I think you must be the tallest person I've ever met. I said, otherwise, I don't think you understand. And, you know, I got home that night. And I burst into tears.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
the
John.
Stress. Well, you know, it's a lot of stress. Mm. And well, I always think of that when I see those young guys out there playing cricket and soccer for their country. And the stress is terrible.
Absolutely.
It really is. Well, that's really interesting. Because that's why I asked. Because I wasn't, you know, like even at the start of that story, when you go, so David Frost rings me up, I'm in New York. Mm. And I go, wow, hello. You know.
Well, I knew David from Cambridge, you see. His last year was my first, and we were sort of friends, and he just then became fantastically famous with the satire shows. That was the week that it was. But when you get used to being with people, it does, you know. It's,
sure.
It must sound funny to be talking about all these people. You know, my God, I had dinner with Michael Palin. No, really? Was he as dull as he usually is? Even worse than he was on those terrible travel programs. You know, they're just pals to us. They,
I know.
But when I meet someone that I really admire, like I did a movie once with David Niven for a week. Yeah. Terrible it was. Do the movie.
Right.
The statue. Don't ever watch it. But when I first met him, it was a little bit like, God, you know, I'm in the same room as him. But you get used to it.
You then start, obviously, writing, and you wrote with Graham. You and Graham were writing partners.
Yes, we met at Cambridge in my very first year, and he left after 2 years and used to do cabaret down at the Royal Court Theatre. They had a little cabaret place, and he used to do cabaret with a fellow called Hendra. But he and I started writing together, and then when I got offered the Frost Report, he was becoming a doctor at Barts Hospital, and he qualified. He was a fully qualified doctor. And we just started writing together. And it was a very good combination because I did the work. I always used to say there were two types of days with Graham working. There were the days when I did 80% of the work and the days when he did 2% of the work. He had two extraordinary abilities. One is he was the greatest sounding board I've ever come across. If Graham laughed, it meant the audience was going to laugh.
Yeah. Right.
And when you're young, in particular, not so experienced, you know, you think, well, is this funny? Are people going to laugh at this? And Graham, it was extraordinary. He was always right. He always knew if it was funny.
But did you feel confident? Because bearing in mind, it happened so quickly.
Yeah.
That you, or the question, I suppose, is, see, I'm going to be here for days, by the way, with you. You and I'm never going
to
let you
go. Sorry, I have nothing else to do.
Did you feel confident writing? Because in a sense, you didn't know how to write sketches for television.
No.
You didn't. You
when
a TV
you're younger,
person.
You have a little less fear, I think. When you've got older, you know how tennis players and golf players, they just seem to be unbeatable, and then suddenly they blow up in the middle of a final round of a golf tournament, and then they're never quite the same again.
So they overthink it, don't they?
Right. And you do it because you're in a show, and you like the people, and you do it, and you get scared during the performance. But I was always motivated, and it's rather sad to say this, I was more motivated by the fear of being bad.
Right.
The terror of being bad. Because when you try and make a joke in public, you know, and people don't laugh, it really is.
I'm used to that feeling.
That's why comedians talk about dying. You see, actors never talk about dying.
No.
But that feeling when you go out there and you knock yourself out and try and be funny, there's this stony silence. I mean, that's about as bad as it gets next to death.
It really is.
But everybody, I think, must get that fear to some extent, don't they? Before they go out, whether it's in the theatre or...
When you're
or
young,
you say,
yes, but you see, the thing about the tour now is it's much easier for me now because people don't say, oh, John Cleese is coming to Leeds. Hmm. I hate him. Let's buy 6 tickets. So they're pre-selected.
Yeah.
If they're out there, it's because they know my stuff and they like it. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bought tickets. And then when I walk out, I have to say there is a lovely reception because if you make people laugh, and it doesn't matter what a kind of a shit you are, because if you look at some of the characters that have been funny in the past, like Alf Garnett, right, and the older Steptoe or W.C. Fields, they're horrible human beings. So is Basil Fawlty. We couldn't stand them if we actually met them. Mm. But those characters, if they make you laugh, you have an affection towards the person who plays the character.
Absolutely. And the nice thing is as well, is when you play live, people have paid money to come and see you. People have put it in their diary. They've made the effort to come and see you.
That's right.
I always think that must be a huge compliment because they've, you know, it's a hassle to go and do stuff.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's a hassle to go for dinner, let alone go and see a show. And then when they get their backside in the seat, there is an element of, right, here we go, entertainment.
Associated with that as well, it therefore must be the hardest situation when you're a comedian and you're going on to play at a bill where it's not just about you, and you're part of a whole evening of different entertainers where people haven't necessarily paid their money to see you, particularly John Cleese or whatever. And therefore, you're going out there, and if you don't make them laugh, you will literally die. They'll give you no...
That's why John has Eric Idle as his support. Yeah. It works. Eric comes on, does a few songs, tells a few stories.
Well, I actually did the Sydney Opera House about 2 months ago, and I was introducing a lot of young comedians, some Australian, some English. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That, you know, again, the response there from the audience was quite patchy. I mean, I did one sketch that didn't work very well.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really funny, and I'd done it once before. And it wasn't what they were expecting, because I was making fun of the alimony, and I was saying, I'll do it. kind of thing. You know, I'd do, bits of silly walk. I'd do Monty Python sketches. Right. I'll do the parrot sketch.
Whatever you want.
If you give a few quid or a few Australian dollars. And this was a setup. And then people in the audience offered me sort of $15 if they could hit me with a piece of wood or kick me in the ghoulies or this kind of thing, which I thought was rather funny. But I found the audience really did want me to do the parrot sketch. I can't believe that they still want it. But it's a bit like those rock groups, you know. They write some new music, they're excited about it, and the audience just wants to hear the things that they wrote in the 70s.
Yeah, play something we know.
It is. It's for a comedian. See, we don't have this with our job. There is no... you know, we never get requests to do a link again. You know, the nearest we have is we do parody songs and people like the parody songs. Yeah. We play an old parody song, people go, oh, I love that. Yeah. Oh, if you play this one. But we never
That's the only example, really, isn't it? Though?
They never asked Dominic to read the news bulletin that he read in March of, 2008. Yeah. It just doesn't happen.
That's a funny idea.
But with comedians, you have your greatest hits. It just
And of course, when I, sketches. Again, because I'm so old, when this started, you didn't have all this material out there on the internet and DVDs in stores. I mean, once a movie'd come out, you either saw the movie or it left the cinema and you never saw it again for 10 years until it was re-released.
Sure.
You know? And when I was, when I got to Cambridge, the great hero there was Peter Cook. I have to say, the only genius that I ever worked with, an idol of mine, and a lovely, lovely man. But everything I heard from people there was at second hand. They would tell me about the sketches. I remember sitting with Trevor Nunn, who directed the first show I ever did, and Trevor sat and recounted some of Peter Cook's sketches, but it's the only way that you heard them was someone else telling you about them. Yeah. They weren't on tape.
Yeah. And now, 10 minutes after you finish your performance, it'll be on YouTube.
That's right.
You know, which is ridiculous, but that's the way of the world.
For free, John, for free!
Oh, yes, I know.
What the hell's going on?
Well, I think it's that the people who set the internet up didn't... they had this feeling that
they weren't business savvy.
Well, yes, and also they didn't think that if authors are going to actually eat, they've got to be able to sell their books.
They obviously didn't have an ex-wife to pay for.
That's right.
They would have been motivated differently.
You watch till those internet people suddenly then have alimony to pay. Then they'll be charging the internet, but like a toll booth at every website. Well, listen, John, we're going to do the news, and then we're going to play a couple of songs, and I want to talk more about stuff.
Then we could have an experiment, because I'll do one or two of the news items again.
Oh, okay. Brilliant. Really, I love
that. Write them down while they're doing them, and then we'll try them again.
Exactly. All right. Well, John is here, and we'll be back with more of Mr. John Cleese. First of all, Dominic... Did you enjoy that, John, that news bulletin? Mm.
Yes, I was thinking, making fun of it. And then the first
it's kind of more serious.
It was terror plot that was followed by a death in Afghanistan and then a stabbing and then a Chelsea loss. So there's nothing we can comment there. I just remember from the Frost Report, a news item which I vaguely remember, it was like the oldest man in Britain, Mr. Ernest Singleton of Halifax, who was 111 at his last birthday. Is still alive.
Tom, could you not do some lighter stories, maybe? You could do finally's about puppies or kittens or
rabbits.
Sorry,
John, it's all very... Yeah, it wasn't very funny today, was it? It's all a bit... Yeah.
John got his little pencil and a pad out.
Oh, sorry.
And he goes, well, we'll do some greatest news stories, greatest hits. And then you come in with the first one. And I literally saw him write down, terror. And then he kind of looked at me and then looked down again.
Spammy.
And then every story was like, right. And I think he was craving for her. And Fluffy the puppy has been found alive and well.
Exactly.
Or a political statement.
You know,
or somebody from News International saying they had no idea.
No idea at all. Things don't happen, John,
That's the best laugh at the moment. And they believe it. You'd expect us to believe it, you know?
Oh, man. Well, listen, John is here, and John, you'll be so excited to hear the news that you are trending on Twitter.
Is that right?
Well, yep.
Yeah. Wow.
Thank you very much.
Trending in the United Kingdom. Just ahead of Bruce Springsteen.
I saw Bruce Springsteen booed at the Royal Albert Hall. I nearly mentioned it 10 minutes ago because he started singing some new songs and the audience didn't want to hear the new songs and so they booed him.
People don't like change.
Wow. There you go.
Extraordinary moment.
It is. People want to hear what they want to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I often think with bands, when you go to see a band live and it's the thing that you always go, let's say you go see U2. And you say, I really want to hear with the Streets of No Name. It's one of my favourite songs, or One, or whatever, or whoever it may be. Yeah. you know, and you don't, you forget that they have done this show every night for a year.
Yeah.
And it just so happens they are rolling through the town that I'm in before they move on. But for me, I've been waiting, I've got my tickets and all that. And it's not until you think, God, they must... When that guitar starts at the beginning, with the Edge going ding, 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 and we all go, yay! Is Bono going, I think I'll have a bath when I get back to that town. Well, I'll tell you what, I think I saw Shepherd's Pie on that room service.
They must go through
that's
the motions.
Right. That's
they
right.
must do.
And the first time that we did Monty Python in New York, now this was really weird, and I went on to do one of the sketches, let's say it's the parrot sketch, and I say, hello, I have a complaint. Cheers! I mean, the roof comes off. Oh, this is going to be fun. Michael Palin and I then play the whole parrot sketch to complete silence. And we're looking at each other, and we're thinking, what's happened? What's gone wrong? And then we get to the end of it, huge cheer. And I came off, and I said to a stagehand, New York stagehand, I said, what is going on? And he said, come and watch. And he took me to the curtain. There's a little bit of gauze in the curtain. You can watch the audience. And he said, watch the audience. They were all doing the lines.
Really?
They were sitting there, looking from Michael to me and back again, doing the lines of the sketch. They knew it better than we did.
Sure.
And one night, Michael made me laugh. We were doing the parrot sketch, and, well, how did the line guy supposed to say? He says he doesn't have any parrots left, but he's got a slug. And I say, does it talk? And he's supposed to say, not really. And he said, well, it mutters a bit, and that made me break up a bit. When I came back to sort of got my laughter under control, I've forgotten where we were. And I was so relaxed. I said to the audience, I said, what's the next line? And about 70 of them shouted.
Great.
And then I said, oh, well, you know it better than I do. So then we had a wonderful performance in which the audience were doing my lines and I was conducting them and Michael was doing the responses, but they knew it better than we did.
So in proper hardcore fans then.
Yes.
These are your greatest hits. That's your Born in the USA.
But you wonder why did they come? And the stagehand said to me, this is not an ordinary performance. They're just here to be with you. They know the material. They've laughed at the material. It isn't funny anymore. They just want to share it with you. And you suddenly realize, oh, it's not a performance in any ordinary sense.
But I think, though, like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld did, after Seinfeld, he did, like, a one final tour.
Right.
Of his material that he'd done for years. And I think he called the tour something like I'm Telling You for the Last Time or something. And the DVD is literally, at the beginning, a load of great American comics. And they're throwing their favourite... They're burying Jerry Seinfeld's material, routine, and they're all throwing in their favourite jokes, like dirt on top of the coffin. And then the show starts.
Yeah.
And then he went, right, I am writing... brand new material. I've done that, now I'm going to
never hear
this
again.
But that's how it works. This is a very. I hope this
but
is
it's very
interesting
hard,
to people
you
listening.
Say, I talk to a lot of stand-ups, and what they all say is there's a moment when they have to throw away material, which is great and works, and they throw it away, and then they have to start from scratch. And they say, and when I start from scratch with new material, I have a lot of bad nights. They all admit that at the beginning with the new material. See, that's why when you're doing comedy material, you've got to work on it with the audience. And I was very annoyed that on DVD, a couple of the London critics came on the first night before I'd ever had a chance to do it to an English audience before, because you find they laugh at this and they don't laugh at that.
Yeah,
you actually can't guess.
Of course, audiences are different and you've just got to suss them out. Well, anyway, look, let's play a song and then we'll come back. I want to talk to you about who you find funny today and things that make you laugh and all that and make you relevant to the young hip Radio 1 listeners so we don't get told off for doing an interview with an old fart for too long. So basically that's what
I thought that was the point in the interview.
Kind of. John is with us. We'll have more in a bit. It's 8:43. I know that's one of John's favourite tracks at the moment, Gym Class Heroes.
Yeah, I see him singing.
Stereo Hearts.
Is that the name? Yeah. Hey, there's a new group called The Beatles. Have you come across them?
They're the terrific. Beatles? That's never going to work. The Beatles?
I know, it's not a good name.
John Cleese is here. He has a DVD which is out today, which is called The Alimony Tour. It's John live at the Bath Theatre Royal.
That's very, right, very nice. Beautiful theatre. And then a smaller audience too, which is nice, you know.
He would like it if he could sell approximately 17 million DVDs, so he's all right for the next 6 months of alimony.
Or maybe I could just send them all to Alice Faye.
There you go, you could just do that.
Cut out the middle of it.
Oh, man.
that you were talking about who makes me laugh now.
Yeah, I want to know, because obviously we're talking... There'll be people listening who have followed your career. There'll be people listening who know you from certain bits, which is remarkable. But that's the way it is. That's life. Yeah.
No, that's right.
Somebody on Twitter, and I can't find the name because I lost it... They were surprised to find out that you were tall because you play a short man in the Shrek movie, and therefore their brain said that John Cleese and that voice must be short, which is fascinating.
We needn't speak to them because they won't be able to afford a DVD, will they?
No. So, who do you like? Who makes you laugh? Who do you like?
I always pick Eddie Izzard out because I think he's a bit of a genius.
Right.
I'm talking about more modern ones, because otherwise Peter Cook's in. And what I love about Eddie, whom I know quite well, is that he walks onto the stage and, you know, I think he likes the fact that he doesn't know what he's going to say first. Mm-hmm. And that terrifies me because, as I say in the show, because basically in the DVD I talk a lot about Forty Towers, a lot about Monty Python, a lot about Fish Called Wanda, and I say, if you want to understand the Pythons, you've got to understand we were a group of writers.
Yeah.
And we used to squabble and fight always about the material. We never squabbled or fought about who was going to play which role.
Right.
Which we would have done if we were primarily performing.
Or fought about the inclusion of which material.
We liked it, whether it was good enough, whether it should be changed, and when we were doing the movies, the plot and all that kind of thing, but never about who's going to play what. So I like to get everything very prepared, and I love it when somebody will go out, like I saw Bill Cosby live once, and Eddie Izzard, and they really don't know what they're going to say next. And it's hair-raising for me. I couldn't do it. I'd be so scared. But I think it's wonderful. I think Bill Hicks was the biggest discovery for me. Now, I don't know if people know this guy, but 15 years ago, I discovered him. I was doing a show with Rowan Atkinson's company, and they said, have you seen this guy? And I thought he was the greatest social comedian I've ever come across. Everything that Lenny Bruce was supposed to be and wasn't. And then, within 3 months, he was dead. Hmm. Pancreatic cancer. Hmm. But do listen to one of those. I think he was quite extraordinary. I compared a show, It's for Laughs, at Sydney Opera House, Louis C.K. I think he's really good. And he was the guy who said to me that he throws his material away once a year.
Oh, really?
And he comes out and he says, when I go into the clubs, the new material, I say, I have a lot of bad evenings. And I like the honesty, you know. I think Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, they were the most important comedians in the last 50 years because they really influenced the last election. And I thought that comedians never really had an important political impact, but those guys basically did more to get Obama elected than anyone else. And then I think Michael McIntyre and Bill Bailey, I compared them at Prince Charles's 60th, and I hadn't seen either of them before, and I thought they were both, in very different ways, absolutely marvelous. Mm. But just a hint. You see, young people always want to know what's the next thing.
Yeah.
There's incredible stuff in the archives. And the most laughter I've had in the last 2 years was when I was watching a lecture on an American comedian from the late 50s called Sid Caesar. And the guy's written his biography, and they showed two clips from Sid Caesar's show, which was called The Show of Shows. They were the two funniest things I've seen in the last 3 or 4 years. So don't we hold back going back to Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton and Chaplin, because some of the greatest humor's back there and a lot better than most of the stuff that's going to come out next year.
Well, it'll depress you then to know that I was excited that you were coming in because you were in Will and Grace.
Oh, yes.
I loved
Will and Grace.
I was like, John from Will and Grace.
John, meet Allard, a fascinating character in every way, shape and form.
I love doing Will and Grace because it was quite unlike anything, because everyone thinks I must be like Basil Fawlty. Obviously, if I've played that part, I must be like him. I presumably think, well, he must also be like Archie in Wonder, you know. Yeah. But Will and Grace was great because I was playing this awful seedy man
who
fancied his own daughter. You remember?
And went with Karen.
Minnie Driver, yes.
Who was my favourite character on the show.
Oh, she was wonderful.
Brilliant.
Yeah. You know, your body of work is amazing. And
It really is. Sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I'm shaving and I look at them and I think, my body of work, and I pass out.
And your body, by the way.
Yeah.
And your body is amazing.
Yeah. For a man of 72,
you're a very attractive
disgusting.
Man. You're still a very sexy man. Let me tell you that. John, by the way...
You should see his expression.
Weirdly... John, we've been talking about this recently, the Muppet Show. John appeared on the Muppet Show.
Oh, God, I love that.
We were talking about only the other day, weren't we? We were sort of reminiscing about how brilliant the Muppet Show was.
Oh, and you see, they did it in England because the Americans would not give them an adult time slot. In here, they got a 6 o'clock or something like that, so people would come back from work and watch them. And I knew those guys, Henson and Frank Oz, and I just love that show.
It's genius.
Performing with Kermit, I mean, it's like performing with someone live, because he can do anything with the expressions of his face. And I remember I had to sing a song, and I'm so bad at singing. I was once in a Broadway musical. I was forbidden to sing. I had to, seriously, Tommy Steele musical called Half a Sixpence, I had to mime. And I was so bad. I was singing this song with Kermit. I thought, I'm going to screw it up. And I screwed it up, and I screwed it up, and I screwed it up. And finally, I did a take that was good. And I said, "Way!" And so I patted Kermit on the head, and I thought, what am I doing? I am patting Jim Henson on the knuckles. But they were so alive that it was like performing with
them. That's a skill, isn't it? You know, making something, you know, appear real and human.
And that's because they'd done it all their lives. You know, they started when they were five. But he could just do a tiny movement, and suddenly Kermit would look shy or cheeky. It was
so clever.
John, let me do some kind of fairly quick questions with you. What is your vegetarian status at the moment?
Wikipedia says I'm vegetarian. I never have been and never will be.
You never have been? Okay.
Brilliant.
It also says my mother was an acrobat, which I made as a joke about 30 years ago, so that's now in print.
Also, now, I'm not sure, Dominic, who reads our news, who you heard reading the happy news earlier, I'm not sure if this is...
You got any more deaths for us?
No.
Any ferries going down in Bangladesh or now, train clashes?
I don't know if you have this in common with Dominic, or once again, whether I've got this wrong. I think you like lemurs. You're a fan of lemurs.
I love little lemurs.
Oh, now, in that case, here we go.
Yeah, strap yourself in.
What?
Dominic is a big fan of the lemurs.
I had the honour of opening a lemur enclosure.
Where?
At Whipsnade Zoo.
Hey, wonderful.
Look at that.
I'll take you there anytime you fancy.
All right. I love the little creature. And this is my proudest bet, because you know I turned down a peerage.
Right.
Right? I did not turn down the next offer, which was to have a species of lemur named after me.
Wow.
There
wow.
is a little lemur in Madagascar called John. No, sorry. There's a... That's the grasshopper joke from the bar. Do you know that?
Yeah.
The grasshopper jumps into the bar and sits on the bar stool, and the barman says, we got a drink named after you. And the grasshopper says, what, Norman? What was I? It's called Avahi Clesii.
Wow.
Or Cleese's Woolly Lemur. And it is a very dear, very dull, very tiny little lemur. But when I'm dead and gone, I'll still have a lemur named
after me. What an honour. That's brilliant.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah. See now, Dominic.
That's amazing.
This Dominic
is amazing.
Envy, yeah, I can see it.
To a lesser extent, but still an honour, is that one of the sea lions at Whipsnade is actually named Dominic after our very own Dominic.
It is, yeah. They had a sea lion pup that was born, and they named him Dominic, yeah.
Very good. Well, the moustache is quite similar.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly, yeah. And the bald head. But yeah, anytime you fancy lemur spotting.
I will come to Whipsnade.
Yeah,
man.
Do. Yeah.
And he can get you one for free, so you don't have to pay.
Wow.
I'm just thinking about you,
what
John.
What about this afternoon? I've got a couple of interviews, but I can
cancel. Do you know, I'm free this afternoon.
All right, we'll go lemur spotting.
Why not? Let's do that.
Right. You've had weirder Mondays.
Well, yes, I have. I'm free.
Do you go on the Twitter, John? Do you tweet?
I tweet a bit, and my marvellous friend Gary Scott Irvine, who has been my keeper and assistant and CEO for 24 years, does some of the twittering from me.
Right.
For me.
Do you do it yourself ever?
Yes.
You do, right.
Sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah, just depending where I am. It's just when I'm travelling a lot, I forget to do it, so Gary does something.
Oh, well, that's good. All right, well, do you know what your name is on Twitter? I don't actually know what your name is.
I don't even know what that means. What do you mean?
Well, it's so people can find it. Do you know what? Don't worry. Do you know what, John? Don't worry about it.
All right.
It's what your name is on there, so people can find
it. It is John Cleese.
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that wasn't
isn't that handy?
That would make sense in many ways, wouldn't
no
it?
No lemurs or anything, just John Cleese, which is great.
All right.
I have a question. Do you mind? Yes. I've seen a few people text in,
sure,
asking, are you in the new James Bond film?
No, I don't think I can be, because they've just done a photograph of everyone that's going to be in it. I was in it for two with Pierce, and then they decided they wanted a grittier, less humorous approach, so they took out Moneypenny and Q, and that worked very well for the first one, which was Casino Royale. Then everyone thought it was missing in the second one, and Dame Judi Dench said something about maybe we should have more humour. But there was a photograph in the paper of the new group, and they've obviously decided.
And that's how you find out?
Well, yeah, oh yes. Oh, this is quite seriously. This is what's so odd about the film business is that they never tell you. But I think the trouble is, of course, you see, I'm a foot and a half taller than Daniel Craig, and to have Q there towering over him, then they'd have to put him on a box, and that, you know, hiring boxes cost money.
Absolutely,
well, yeah.
That's
my times are hard these days.
Yeah.
You know? Are you happy with that question?
Thank you very much.
Good question.
Does anybody else have any questions for John? This is like kind of being a guest on Kids Telly on a Saturday. Little boy over there with the blonde hair.
We were talking about new comedians. I wanted to ask Mr. Cleese whether, have you heard of a comedian called Jim Jefferies, who is an Australian comedian who's now based in the States, because I think that you might like his approach to...
I'm going to write that down.
Jim Jefferies. He's... You know how you suddenly discover people, and I've just sort of discovered him in the last couple of weeks, and he is now my new favourite comedian.
Well, that's great.
I would advise you to, or like you to
seek him out. We should do this. We should swap good names. I mean, everyone knows Bill Bailey. He did a show in the West End about 18 months ago, which is really the best solo show I've ever seen.
Do you have a limit on your humour? Are you, you know, like profanity and whatnot, or sexual content? Are you cool with it?
Well, I think the trouble is there's no such thing as privacy anymore. You see, on the internet, there's a speech that I did when Graham Chapman died, and a lot of people have seen it. Now, when I did that speech, there were about 200 people there, and what I knew is they all knew Graham, and they all knew where that humour was coming from.
Absolutely.
And so to do it to that group was okay, because they kind of, it's like whispering somebody something to a friend in church.
Absolutely.
Or you're at a funeral and you say something that you would never say out loud, but you say it to a friend because he'll understand where it comes from. As you lose privacy, that kind of humour disappears. Mm. And that's why I rather regret the fact there's almost nothing like privacy anymore.
Well, you know, I think... Have you seen Jimmy Carr before?
Yes, he's excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I emceed him once at the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. I thought he was really good.
Yeah. He writes a lot of material.
A lot of material. And what I say is that I think now we've got great stand-ups, but I don't think that the written material for sitcoms is as good as it was, because I don't think the plots are as good as they used to be. I think we've lost the knack of how to structure comedy plots otherwise. But I think the performers are just as talented as they ever were.
I think we've had in this country too many bad sitcoms, and it's hard to get... I think there are great comedies on television.
Yes.
But the
sitcom's a bit of a funny word, though, now, isn't it?
People go, I think you're scared of doing a sitcom, you know, a traditional sitcom.
Yeah. But sometimes people sort of veer away from things and you don't know why. I mean, there was a certain type of sitcom. The fact is, on television, out of any five shows there ever were, you know, there were always three that weren't very good and one that was very good and one that was okay. But now, when you see the sitcoms, the skill is not there in the plotting. And one of the problems is that what they should do is pay the writers twice as much. Mm. They say, would you spend twice as long on a script? We'll pay you twice as much. So you get the same money for the same amount of time. And if they did that, it would improve, because writing a comedy script takes a long time. As I say in the show, Connie Booth and I used to take 2.5 weeks to come up with a plot for Wanda. Nobody takes 2.5 weeks to come. And what the great art in a comedy is, write a funny comedy plot. Then it's easy to write the dialogue.
Yeah.
But if you write a straight plot, which is not really a funny plot at all, and then you have to put jokes in all the way, that's almost harder work.
Mm.
So what I would always say is pay the writers more in exchange for an honourable promise that they will spend twice as much time on it. And then the comedy standard would go straight up immediately.
It'd be interesting to see how it affects it, wouldn't it?
I started to write a sitcom, and I had a great idea about a sitcom, which was to write a sitcom about a sitcom. And the idea of it was, it was based around the writing and making of a typical ITV sitcom that's a little bit cheesy and a little bit dated. But that's what I was going to write, the people, the actors and the writers making this show. I thought that was a nice premise for a show. So you have somebody who considers himself to be better and above the character than they're famous for. I sat down writing it. John, I got screwed out of my mind. I got so confused writing. This is John.
Yeah, yeah.
He plays this. He's an actor and he's been around for years. Now, in the sitcom, he plays Terry.
Yeah.
Now, and Terry is happy and popular, but in real life, he's very angry. Now, his girlfriend in the show, he doesn't get on with in real life. I ended up writing two characters for each character. I went out of my mind. It's sat on my computer ever since.
That kind of comedy requires incredibly precise writing. Yeah. And you know who I was thinking of who did it? Michael Frayn, Noises Off.
Right.
It's a play about putting on a play.
Putting on a play.
And Michael Frayn, who's one of the most brilliant, nice men I've ever met, he was a philosopher, for Christ's sake. I mean, to pull off that kind of humour, you've got to have a very, very fine logical mind. Like, you know the French guy, Fedor, wrote those French farces in the 1890s?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was a sort of... Yeah. They still get... was one at the Old Vic last Christmas called The Flea in Her Ear. When those get revived, they're like little bits of math. Mathematics. The plot is so perfectly intricately worked out. It's almost an intellectual feat.
Extras, I suppose, got sort of close to that, didn't it? Do you think, in terms of the whole sort of program about a program about it, you know, and different sort of layers?
And I could never figure out when I was watching The Office, and I know it was a faux documentary, but I always wondered, was the idea that it was a documentary necessary? It allowed some kind of humour, but it also meant there was a kind of distancing from the comedy that was going on. And I thought it worked.
Yeah.
It's a fine series, but I always thought to myself, I didn't like the distancing, the sort of alienation device of looks at the camera.
Mm.
It seemed to me to take the temperature down or to put something between you and the audience.
Mm. You know, I'm still thinking about this sitcom. I think I'll... We should have a crack at it, John.
All right. You send me the first draft.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've just given you the idea.
Does it exist?
He wants to be like Graham.
Is he fibbing?
If you could write 80% of it and then I'll tickle it up, that'd be great.
And could you have it done?
I'll wait till the alimony's paid off.
Okay. Okay. We'll do it under a pseudonym. John, lovely to see you. Lovely to meet you. I could talk to you for hours. I really could.
Well, and you can't because I have to go and see the lemurs at Whipsnade. Yeah,
well, I know that. Dominic is going to take John to see the lemurs.
I'll pick you up at 3.
But make sure he's... I think John is on the One Show tonight.
Oh,
so, God love him.
Get him back in good time.
You have to get him back for that.
No problem.
Because if you thought this interview was deep, you wait until he goes on the One Show.
Yeah. You're talking about shortbread and canal museums.
Oh, yes.
Incredible.
Now, it's been 100 years since cat's eyes were invented.
the best thing is that then they ask you, even though you've come in for the sole reason of promoting whatever you're there to promote, I love it when they then ask you what your opinion is on canal barges or on cat's eyes or on... You know.
I did one on a radio show. My ex-wife, Alice Faye, had written a book about relationships with adults and their mothers.
Mm.
And I'd just done a Bond movie. And the interviewer said to me, Mr. Cleese, well, what did you learn on the Bond movie that would help you to deal with your mother? And I was unable to speak.
Yeah.
I just started to laugh, and I completely lost it. Mm. And I sat there, cackling away for about 2 minutes. It was wonderful and deeply embarrassing. And they looked at each other, and I went on laughing. I just couldn't stop.
Well, I think we've all learned something today about our own mothers during this chat. Please go and get John's DVD. If not for him, then for his ex-wife's golden swimming pool. It's called The Alimony Tour, and it's out today. And, John, you can come back whenever you wish to the show.
What a lovely thing to say.
Or whenever ex-wife needs topping up.
But let me just mention, the alimony stuff is only the first 3 or 4 minutes on the show. The rest of it is basically Python, Faulty Towers. And also funny stuff about growing up in Western Supermare and why the Germans bombed Western Supermare.
There you go. It's all...
a mystery for historians over the eras.
Well, just go and buy it. Just go and get it. It's out today. I think we'll all go and do that, and John can hopefully rent that flat that he's always been looking to rent.
In Bath.
Mm.
And escape Monaco. ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Cleese. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.